Good morning. It is Tuesday, July 14th. We are following up on the escalating situation in the Strait of Hormuz and looking at how the ground is shifting under the feet of both political parties and big tech. Here is the news. The United States is currently locked in a cycle of hostilities with Iran, characterized by a return to kinetic operations in the Strait of Hormuz. Despite an administration attempt to maintain a ceasefire through a memorandum of understanding, that agreement has effectively collapsed. The conflict is now operating on an ad hoc basis. The U.S. is conducting tactical strikes in response to Iranian aggression, while simultaneously attempting to signal that a formal war has not resumed. It is a state of Schrödinger's war. This term captures the absurdity of avoiding a formal declaration to prevent total escalation while still engaging in active, dangerous military operations to protect shipping. Here is the thing about this approach. It is reactive. Because there is no coherent grand strategy, the administration is merely responding to Iranian provocations in the moment. This gives the Iranian regime the upper hand, allowing them to shift the goalposts of acceptable behavior by trading lives for concessions. The U.S. strategy seems to treat foreign policy like a business negotiation, focusing heavily on short-term optics like oil prices and stock market performance. It is a volatile way to run a country. It has also managed to alienate European allies, who are increasingly wary of the U.S. demanding reimbursement for guarding the strait while simultaneously playing the role of the global guarantor of free trade. Meanwhile, the conflict in Ukraine is shifting. Ukraine is gaining tactical momentum, and the economic toll of deep strike strategies against Russian energy infrastructure and diesel supplies is starting to bite. While Russia maintains a facade of stability, the internal distress is real. The U.S. has authorized Ukraine to manufacture Patriot missiles, signaling a commitment to a long-term conflict. But here is the problem. The administration's rhetorical support for Ukraine is erratic. It leaves the trajectory of that aid and the long-term viability of the effort in serious doubt. In the United Kingdom, the investigation into the death of a public figure has been transferred to counterterrorism police. Authorities initially treated the case as a standard homicide, but they have since moved it under an ideological lens following the discovery of new evidence and the arrest of a second suspect on terror-related charges. This is a precarious situation for the government. It is a high-stakes news cycle, and the investigation has become a magnet for political speculation. Figures like Nigel Farage have already shared theories about the motive, prompting other officials to argue that such rhetoric is actively threatening the legal process. It also highlights a systemic problem regarding the safety of public figures. Following the deaths of Joe Cox and David Ames, the distinction between ideologically driven violence and other acts of terror is becoming increasingly difficult for the public to define. The police are now in the unenviable position of managing a high-profile case while navigating a media landscape that prioritizes immediate, opinion-driven narratives over the slow, necessary pace of criminal justice. We are also seeing how market-based surveillance is effectively bypassing constitutional warrant requirements. Data colonialism is the name of the game here. Companies and government agencies are gathering granular behavioral data, things like license plate locations, physical movements, and search histories, to build detailed profiles on individuals. By purchasing this data from private brokers, law enforcement is essentially circumventing the Fourth Amendment. They are accessing information they could not legally collect on their own, and it is creating a deterrent effect on political activism and personal autonomy. This system is self-reinforcing. Corporations monetize this data to influence consumer behavior and political outcomes, then use the profits to lobby for policies that protect the extraction system. It is a feedback loop that favors corporate and state interests over individual agency. It is worth noting, however, that the system is vulnerable to collective action. Public backlash, like the cancellation of partnerships between Ring and law enforcement, shows that localized resistance works. It is not an inevitable byproduct of technology. It is a choice. Finally, in Maine, the fatal shooting of a 26-year-old by ICE agents in Biddeford has brought intense local scrutiny to federal immigration enforcement. This incident has exposed a massive gap between federal authority and local interests. Critics are pointing to an aggressive enforcement model that lacks proper training, which they argue creates instability rather than security. Senator Susan Collins, as chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, has faced significant criticism for not using her power to place conditions on federal funding. The event has become a turning point in Maine politics. You are starting to see candidates like Dan Kleben emerge, who are pushing for structural reforms like banning congressional stock trading and placing strict conditions on agency funding. It signals a shift in the electoral landscape. Voters are moving away from reactive anger and toward a demand for specific, proactive institutional change. For the Democratic Party, the challenge is to move beyond just mobilizing against the status quo and start offering a policy-driven vision that actually addresses the economic and safety concerns of working-class voters. It is a long road, but the status quo is clearly breaking under the weight of its own contradictions. That political friction feels like a constant these days, but the tech world is currently busy tearing itself apart over different kinds of assets. The AI industry is undergoing a messy, high-stakes shift. We are moving away from a simple race for the biggest model toward an all-out battle for hardware, infrastructure, and token efficiency. The U.S. administration is changing its export strategy. They have granted the UAE license-free access to advanced AI chips. This is a privilege usually reserved for the closest of allies. The move positions the Gulf as a major hub for AI workloads, effectively trying to speed up global compute capacity while potentially boxing out China. Critics call it a massive security liability and a backdoor for tech leakage. Proponents argue it is the only way to maintain a U.S.-led global network of AI infrastructure. Then there is the economics of the models themselves. Enterprises are moving away from monolithic deployments where they rely on one giant, expensive model for everything. Instead, they are adopting routing architectures. They use small, cheap models for routine tasks and save the expensive frontier models for complex reasoning. This is a structural necessity. As agentic systems, AI that can plan and execute workflows, become the norm, token consumption is skyrocketing. If you used a top-tier model for every single interaction, your operational costs would be unsustainable. We are seeing a clear bifurcation in the market. Companies that cannot offer high-performance models at a low price point, specifically in the $2 to $6 per million token range, are being pushed into niche use cases. The United Kingdom is taking a different path. A group called Cosine AI, pronounced Cosine AI, argues that you do not need billions in capital to compete. They are pushing for smaller, inference-efficient models that prioritize active parameters over massive, dense architectures. Their argument is that targeted national compute and high-quality data loops are more practical than the massive clusters favored by U.S. labs. They are also moving toward agentic engineering, where AI agents must prove their code works in a runtime environment before it is ever reviewed by a human. Look, here is the thing about all of this. We are in a temporary, volatile window where labs are aggressively subsidizing tokens to grab market share. It is great for power users right now, but it is not a stable business model. The real story is the move toward control over the entire stack. From the chips to the data loops, the winners will be the ones who own the infrastructure, not just the ones with the smartest chatbot. Finally, we have to talk about how this actually gets built. There is a growing push to move responsible AI out of the PR department and into the engineering workflow. The consensus among developers is that you cannot just rely on human red teaming anymore. You need automated behavioral testing that scores performance against safety specs in real time. We are seeing a move toward defense-in-depth architectures, where you combine the flexibility of an LLM with the rigid deterministic guardrails, the bounding box, that prevent an agent from going off the rails when it calls an external tool. The industry is finally starting to prioritize immediate, boring risks like data integrity and tool execution errors over the sci-fi long-term catastrophe scenarios. We are moving from the era of vibes to the era of industrial-grade engineering. It is going to be a bumpy transition. Moving from Silicon Valley's legal battles to the track, it seems like even the sport of kings is being forced to play by new rules. The Haskell Stakes at Monmouth Park is shifting the standard for how tracks handle the three-year-old racing season. The race now serves as a win-and-you-are-in qualifier for the Breeders' Cup, which saves owners a $150,000 nomination fee. Trainers like Brad Cox and Chad Summers are focusing on tactical track knowledge, specifically how a horse's cruising speed interacts with local track surfaces. Monmouth Park is also moving away from a traditional wagering-only model. Leadership under Dennis Drazen is pivoting toward a multi-purpose entertainment hub, incorporating sports betting, residential development, and youth sports complexes. The strategy is to use this diversified revenue to fund higher purses, which in turn attracts top-tier fields. It is a calculated move to insulate the track from the volatility of classic racing economics. Meanwhile, the California thoroughbred industry is seeing a structural evolution. Trainers are abandoning single-location barn operations in favor of multi-regional models to maximize horse utility. This is a direct response to shrinking opportunities within single circuits. It explains why high-profile trainers are moving their operations, rather than signaling the systemic failure some observers might fear. The economic data out of California shows a moderate recovery. Maiden special weight purses have climbed to roughly $75,000 over the last 2 years, up from $60,000, while field sizes are projected to contract slightly from 8.7 to 8.5 starters per race. The numbers remain robust by historical standards. Asset management is also tightening. Organizations like Little Red Feather are focusing on data-driven moves, such as transitioning turf horses to dirt surfaces to boost long-term stallion or broodmare value. Finally, Assiniboia, Assiniboia, Downs has updated its wagering menu to favor higher stakes and lower frequency pools. The track added a $50,000 guaranteed late pick 4 and $3 rolling pick 3s. The change forces bettors to move away from covering the entire field toward more selective ticket construction. With higher minimums, the strategy is to identify individual race anchors to keep total investment manageable. Handicappers are advised to look past recent finish positions. The data suggests that horses often lose due to external factors like being forced wide or dealing with an unfavorable rail bias. When the public overweights recent form, it creates value in horses that were unlucky rather than uncompetitive. Additionally, the track is using distance changes in races like the Canada Stakes to filter for stamina. Horses with a history of handling longer distances often outperform their mediocre short-distance form when moving up in class. It is a fascinating, if somewhat cynical, look at the sport. We are seeing a clear divide between tracks trying to become Disney World and those trying to become high-stakes casinos. Either way, the days of the local, low-overhead racetrack are effectively over. You either adapt to the nationalized, diversified model, or you get left behind. The pressure to scale up is clearly everywhere, from the stables at Monmouth to the balance sheets of the NFL. The Seattle Seahawks just sold for $9.6 billion. That price tag confirms that NFL franchises are now essentially untouchable assets. For context, the team was valued at $194 million back in 1997. We are seeing a generational changing of the guard, too. The Paul Allen estate is out, and the family of Vinod Khosla, Vinod Khosla, is in. This marks a shift from legacy owners to venture capital-backed leadership, and you can expect a much more aggressive, data-obsessed approach to how that stadium actually functions. Speaking of data, Major League Soccer is currently running a First Match on Us campaign. They are trying to turn World Cup interest into actual domestic ticket sales. The league isn't looking for quick cash here. They are building a database of first-time attendees to target later. It is a smart play, because their real problem isn't brand awareness. It is turning casual World Cup viewers into people who actually show up to the stadium on a Tuesday night. College sports are looking a bit more chaotic. Jamie Pollard, the longtime athletic director at Iowa State, just retired. He was pretty open about why, citing the pure frustration of managing NIL, or name, image, and likeness, deals, and constant conference realignment. It is a sign that the job has become less about athletics and more about corporate crisis management. When experienced people walk away like this, schools usually pivot toward corporate-style leadership to handle the fundraising and facility upgrades, which usually means the soul of the place goes right out the window. If you have been watching Wimbledon on ESPN, you might have noticed a shift. The broadcast is leaning hard into behind-the-scenes access, locker room footage, and celebrity cameos. It is a move away from traditional play-by-play toward a lifestyle-heavy broadcast model. The trade-off is that franchises have to give networks deeper access to their internal environments. They are essentially trading control for higher engagement. Finally, the Golden State Valkyries are running their franchise like a tech startup. They built their operations on AI and data tools from day one, allowing them to adjust the fan experience in real time. It is a massive departure from the slow, fragmented systems that most established teams are stuck using. This is the new baseline. If you are an expansion team, you are expected to launch with a fully developed, tech-enabled plan, or you are already behind. Overall, the industry is moving from passive sponsorship to active partnership. Whether it is Ally Bank betting on women's sports early to build brand loyalty, or the way global soccer broadcasters are now forced to navigate VAR-induced delays and feed unpredictability, the goal is the same. It is all about capturing proprietary data and controlling the ecosystem around the game. If you aren't doing that, you aren't really playing the game. It is not just the teams that are turning into massive data harvesting machines. The media landscape is changing right along with them. Online news video is becoming the primary way people consume information. This shift is not just a trend, but a fundamental change in habit driven by device access and age. Data shows that in markets like Thailand and Peru, weekly online news video consumption is above 80%. In contrast, the United Kingdom and Germany hover around 50%. That gap is largely due to the influence of traditional public service broadcasting on older generations. Younger people, however, show no signs of adopting those traditional viewing habits as they age. The platform landscape is increasingly split by user intent. Facebook remains the primary place for accidental discovery. YouTube, meanwhile, functions as a destination. More than half of its news viewers go there specifically to watch content. This changes how newsrooms should allocate their efforts. Short-form content works for social discovery, but YouTube supports a robust market for long-form news. In fact, a quarter of YouTube news consumers report regularly watching segments longer than 20 minutes. The living room has reached an inflection point. 70% of younger viewers now access news on smart TVs through apps like YouTube instead of traditional broadcast channels. This forces news organizations to compete directly with streamers like Netflix and Disney Plus for attention on the biggest screen in the house. The takeaway here is that newsrooms need to stop treating video as a generic commodity. Success now requires matching content length to platform design, vertical, short form for social discovery, and long-form, on-demand video for destination platforms. Anything else is just a waste of resources. The economic reality for independent publishers is also shifting, and it is largely due to the rise of zero-click search. 10 years ago, 45% of Google searches resulted in no clicks. Today, that figure is 68%. By providing summaries directly on the search page, tech giants are capturing the value of the information while depriving publishers of the traffic they need to survive. The impact is immediate and, frankly, brutal. Some niche sites have reported traffic drops of up to 75% since the introduction of AI summaries. This is forcing owners to choose between massive income cuts or closing their sites entirely. The paradox is that AI companies need high-quality, human-generated content to train their models. If they destroy the financial viability of the people creating that content, the pool of unique data will shrink. The quality of future AI outputs will almost certainly suffer as a result. Large publishers are responding with a dual-track strategy. Some are creating stripped-down versions of their sites that are easier for bots to read while blocking unauthorized crawlers. Others are pursuing legal action or implementing bot paywalls where AI companies must pay for the right to crawl content. The internet is clearly moving toward a consolidation phase. The open web is being replaced by a walled garden model where only those with the resources to negotiate partnerships or build significant brand authority can survive. If your business model still relies on traditional referral traffic, you are likely looking at an exit. Finally, there is a broader trend of building operational redundancy to mitigate single-point dependencies. This is happening in logistics, finance, and global capital markets. In maritime trade, the vulnerability of the Strait of Hormuz has forced the United Arab Emirates to change its strategy. With Jebel Ali, Jebel Ahly, port activity dropping by up to 95% due to regional conflict, DP World is shifting infrastructure investment to the east coast port of Fujairah, Fujairah. This is a permanent diversification strategy. It acknowledges that the Strait of Hormuz is no longer a reliable route for global logistics. By building a backup on the Gulf of Oman, the UAE is effectively prioritizing supply chain resilience over the efficiency of their traditional hub. In the financial sector, Brazil's PIX, P-E-E-K-S payment system has triggered a protectionist response from the United States. Brazil's system brought 70 million people into the formal economy through mandatory adoption for large banks and capped fees. The United States has threatened tariffs, claiming that this oversight creates a barrier to fair competition for established card models. This suggests that domestic financial innovation is being viewed by global powers as a threat to established payment networks. We are looking at a future of fragmented, regional digital payment ecosystems. Lastly, equity markets are showing a rotation away from the AI-driven tech rally. Capital is moving toward United States small-cap stocks, which have outperformed the S&P 500 this year. This shift is driven by growing skepticism about the near-term profitability of heavy AI infrastructure spending. As the market questions whether tech giants can turn this massive capital expenditure into actual earnings, small-cap companies are absorbing the redirected capital. These developments all point to the same thing. The world is moving away from centralized, high-efficiency models toward decentralized, resilient alternatives. Whether it is moving ports, creating sovereign payment rails, or broadening equity exposure, the goal is the same. It is about insulating economic activity from single points of failure. Organizations that recognize these shifts as structural changes, rather than temporary anomalies, are the ones that will actually be around to see what happens next. As we all shift our habits to keep up with that digital feed, it turns out the things we value in the physical world are changing, too. Lab-grown diamonds now account for 50% of the engagement ring market. They cost 90% less than natural stones, forcing De Beers to cut wholesale prices in private while trying to reposition natural diamonds as a luxury, artisanal product. It is a classic move. Change the branding when the utility gap becomes impossible to ignore. Meanwhile, office culture is evolving into something resembling a call center. New OpenAI models that mimic human social cues are pushing voice-based interaction over typing. Since voice input is 3 times faster and 20% more accurate than the keyboard, companies are installing close proximity microphones. It is a massive shift in ergonomics and privacy, and it's happening whether your office is ready for the noise or not. In the so-called burnout economy, Gen Z is trading bar tabs for fitness classes. Spending is moving away from nightlife and toward evening Pilates or spin sessions. The gym is effectively becoming the new social club. It is a pivot toward performative self-care as a coping mechanism for modern work, forcing service businesses to compete with fitness studios for your evening budget. Finally, the market is placing a premium on what some call AI-pilled talent. Companies are paying more for employees who can leverage AI to hit 10 times the usual production gains. But there is a catch. This isn't just about technical skill. It is about a bias toward action and a refusal to use planning as a substitute for actual work. Look, the common thread here is pretty stark. Whether it is diamond marketing, voice-based labor, or the rise of the gym as social hub, we are seeing a total collapse of traditional models. We are all just trying to automate the boring stuff and find a place to sweat out the anxiety. That is a hell of a way to run an economy. From the diamonds on our fingers to the way we price our own labor, everything is getting a serious reality check. A few other things worth knowing today. If you are sick of being treated like a commodity, stop charging by the hour. Value-based pricing is the only way to escape the race to the bottom because it frames your work as a unique solution instead of a standard unit of time. Systemic racism was a massive, state-sanctioned hurdle for innovation in the early 20th century. By denying black inventors institutional support, the system allowed fraudulent intermediaries to steal their intellectual property without ever facing a single consequence. Fundraising is less about the math and more about the emotional math of persuasion. You get people to open their wallets by subtracting fear from their desire, and trust is the only tool that actually kills that fear. The Senate is looking at a real leadership vacuum as veterans move toward the exit. It is forcing a generational shift toward younger, more aggressive lawmakers who have absolutely no interest in the old-school channels for bipartisan negotiation. That is going to be a hell of a thing to watch unfold. That is the state of play for Tuesday. Take it easy out there, and I will see you back here tomorrow.